Our present subject is the unexpected and not so popular topic of death, judgment, and hell. Over the years, our modern Jesuit generals have warned us never to give the spiritual exercises, even a short weekend, we call this a long weekend, without speaking on death, judgment, and hell. As an obedient son of St. Ignatius, I am hereby talking on this topic. We know something of the meaning and gravity of sin. What bears emphasis is that sin by its very nature is related to God. There is no such thing as just doing wrong and hurting oneself or injuring society. The essence of sin is that it offends God. If this is true, and it is, we would expect God, whom sin offends, not to be impassive to the commission of sin. God reacts every time we sin. The reaction we call punishment. There are, just for the record, two kinds of punishment that God inflicts on sin. One we call punitive, and the other remedial. Punitive punishment means that God penalizes sin in order to inflict suffering or pain where the person had offended God by indulging himself against the will of God. I guess I've taught theologically the subject of sin for about 25 years. The more I teach it, the more simple it becomes. I have come to say that sin is man acting against the will of God, and pain is God acting against the will of man. It's all that simple. We do something which indulges ourselves, though we know it's contrary to God's will, and then God does something which will pain us precisely where we have offended Him. Moreover, God punishes, as we say, remedially. In the first case, pain is the price of sin. The deepest things in life can be expressed in monosyllables. Pain is the price of sin. Had there been no sin, there would be no pain. But that's not all. God can also inflict pain. but not precisely to have us make up with suffering for our indulgence of some creature against God's will. That's the first kind of pain. The second kind of pain God inflicts for sin, indeed, but in order to bring the sinner back to himself. Against that introduction, we now want to reflect on the different ways in which God causes pain. And the first subject is death. It is remarkable, in a world where people seem to be doubting just about everything, no one in his right mind doubts that every human being will die. But while we know from reason that death is inevitable, faith adds to our knowledge by telling us that originally we were not to have died, that our mortality is the fruit of sin. We were to have inherited from our first parents, had they remained faithful, not only the life of God, which we call the state of grace, but also immortality of body. Well, they sinned, and they died, and we will die. What is the lesson? The universal price of sin is our bodily death. Faith tells us that only one man sinned, yet the whole human race is now and will until the end of time pay the consequences of his sin. There is no such thing as ever sinning in solitude. Everyone who sins, first and most drastically, Adam, but everyone who sins affects others, indeed, affects the whole human race. Rather than blame Adam, which we are sometimes tempted to do, we should look to ourselves and ask ourselves how much we have contributed to the blindness and the weakness and the estrangement from God of so many people because we have sinned. We look over the chaos in once flourishing institutions of Catholic Christianity, see the defection in the United States of 10,000 priests since the Council, and the departure by now of some 60,000 religious women in America. We look at the shambles in family life. A judge in New York City, a Catholic who had been witnessing civil marriages, told one of my students that 10 years ago he would average about 400 civil marriages he would witness each year. Last year, he had only 10. hundreds of thousands of young people don't even bother going through the formality of marriage. And the largest Lutheran seminary in the world is in Chicago. The denomination which it represents in its last synod approved as consistent with the gospel two unmarried people living together. It is one thing, however, to reflect on what's happening, but much more difficult to strike our breast and say, mea culpa, my fault. Only God knows to what extent we have contributed to the mountain of sin in a nation like ours. What we should be told, all of us, is that we have made our contribution. So the first lesson, that sin occurred in Adam's case and in its own measure in our case, is a social sin. That everyone who sins affects many others besides himself. That's part one of this meditation. Death, then, is something that will happen to all of us. There are two things about death that we should all at least once, say a year, be told. First is the certainty that we shall die. But more than that, not only are we sure to die, but we will die as we have lived. If we now live in God's friendship, we have, as far as it is humanly possible to have certitude, we shall die in His friendship. Isn't that good to hear? God is merciful, and there are occasions, as we know, when some lifelong sinner, estranged from God for years, suddenly makes a deathbed conversion. Some of you may remember President Calles of Mexico, who persecuted the church for years, some 50 years ago. Gave the church many martyrs. A Jesuit priest, friend of mine, told me, Calles made his last confession, died with the sacraments, completely reconciled with God. But if there are deathbed conversions, let's be sure there are no deathbed perversions. No one on his deathbed suddenly turns his back on God. We need to hear that. It may at times seem hard as we drag ourselves through life. I don't think the figure is too strong. Call life climbing a tall mountain, walking a difficult road, plunging through a jungle. Whatever the lifespan is and whatever the struggles we have to undergo through life, let's keep telling ourselves, as I do more than once every day. Life is short. All we have to do is remain in God's fellowship. And we've made it. We know what this means, by and large. For most of us, it means walking hand in hand with God through the darkness. Well, then it's all over. Thank God. I may have mentioned to some of you that whenever the New World Almanac comes out, usually in November of a current year for the next year, the first thing I look up is in the vital statistics. What is the average lifespan of men in the United States as of this year? And I calculate my chronological age and I figure, well, Lord, I have less to go. And I know I'm not being naive. If a great saint like Ignatius could do that, a sinner like me surely can. That then is the double certitude. We shall all die, and we shall all die as we have lived. So what's the incertitude? It is only such minor details as when, where, and under what circumstances God will call us. My pastor in Cleveland, Monsignor Shepherd, who inspired me with wanting to become a priest, died on the stage, no less, distributing the awards to the high school graduates from the parish high school. Suddenly suffered a heart attack, and the principal rushed up, a little sister of Notre Dame. I don't think she was 5 foot tall. He died in her arms. Francis Regis, one of my special Jesuit patrons, died in the confessional. Perfect. May I suggest that we should honestly and daily anticipate death? Why not? Plan for it, even look forward to it, and accept it daily from the hands of God. Because although we die only once physically, I hope you've heard this before. We are to die 1,000 times spiritually. Every time anticipating what will happen only once, we tell the Lord, I accept from your hands whatever kind of death you will send me, with all its pains, penalties, and sorrows. In expiation for my sins, for the souls in purgatory, for the conversion of sinners, for the people who will die, I say this prayer twice a day. One first thing in the morning, one the last thing at night. For those who will die today, or who will die tonight, and for your greater glory. Why not profit from this great gift of God, what St. Francis called Sister death. That's part one. Part two. After death comes the judgment. The trouble with a preposition after is that it's not quite accurate, because the nearest thing to a split second is the time it takes for us to be judged after we die. We believe there are two judgments, the one that takes place the moment we die, and the other that will take place the moment the world dies. We call the first the particular, and the second the general judgment. What is most satisfying is to remind ourselves who is going to judge us. You know who? The gentle, loving, merciful Jesus. Isn't that marvelous? We should have seen a lot of each other during life. Well, he's going to judge us when we die. And as we are hoping, not as though he's going to weigh the pros and cons of our life. Oh, no. Whatever our name is, he will tell us what our lot is in eternity. One of the difficulties with the word judgment is that it has a negative implication. We assume that a judge judges people who have done wrong. In ordinary human language, we usually associate judgment with inflicting a penalty. But judges also acquit. Consequently, while reflecting on the fact that we shall be judged because we've done wrong, we can also convince ourselves that we shall be judged according to all of our deeds. And, please God, we will have done a lot of good deeds. Before I leave the judgment, let me add one more comment. Sometimes we may wonder why Christ should bother with a second judgment, which we call general, at the end of time. The main reason, so the church tells us, is that the whole world might learn and glorify God by seeing how the good deeds that each individual has done have had their beneficial consequences going on year after year, century after century, until the end of time. In other words, one of the main reasons for the general judgment is for the whole world to learn how much good we have done in the short life we've lived, how many people have benefited by sometimes the least of our morally good actions. And on the last day, all of that will be made known in order to glorify God. A single act of kindness to another person that perhaps the individual never noticed. Like as I told some of you, the man who pushed me off the subway into the crowd. As I looked back before the subway doors closed and said, God bless you. Or the man who used my private telephone in New York in my absence and put in many long, long distance phone calls and out of such allowance as I have, I am to pay for those phone calls. Every act of patience, every act of mercy has consequences that roll on until the end of time. All of this will be unfolded on the last day.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.